So if you're feeling stretched too thin, if your managers are managing a whole bunch of people and really aren't being able to plug into one or two specific areas of the product, then that's probably a sign that you need to restructure.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, we're joined by Doug Gaff. Doug is the VP of Engineering at Zapier. They're the software solution that helps your other software work together more effectively. His team recently crossed the 100 engineer threshold, and they're currently going through some exciting transitions as an organization. Their current inflection point has them moving from a functional focus to a vertical product focus. We'll talk about what that means. We are excited to share what Doug has learned through this transition. This was an awesome conversation where we talked about team slicing. We talked about how to get the most out of your data science team. And we talked about how to deal with transitioning from a monolith to microservices and when that's actually necessary. Zapier has gone through really fast growth, so I think we're going to learn a lot from this conversation. And now, here's my conversation with Doug Gaff. Doug, thank you so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Great. Happy to be here.
What is the most important inflection point in your career that got you to where you are today?
Yeah, so my first vice president position was probably the biggest inflection point. It was the biggest stretch professionally for me as I learned to build out a team from basically nothing and to build multiple layers of management and create an engineering organization that could build a lot of complex products very quickly. There's a ton of learnings from that we could dig into if you want, but that was a big inflection point for me.
Yeah, I'd love to look like, you could give your past self advice about that whole building teams that can create complex software. What do you wish you would have known then?
The first thing is that I needed to advocate more strongly for a recruiting team to build out the organization. We were a bootstrap startup that was profitable, but also pretty conservative in how we would spend money. And I used a lot of external recruiting firms to help build out the initial organization, but we were co-located. So this wasn't a remote company. This was a totally co-located company. And hiring was brutal in the Boston area. The market was market has always been really, really strong in the Boston area, but hiring was really brutal. And working with external recruiting firms that work on contingency is a tough thing to do because they're motivated differently than other recruiting firms say, because they're trying to close candidates. And I think building a stronger recruiting function inside the company earlier would have accelerated the growth of the organization and helped us do other stuff faster.
So when it's time to hire that first internal recruiter, or would you recommend going straight to an internal a technical recruiter or a recruiter that's not necessarily technical first?
It depends on which part of your organization you're scaling. But if in most companies, engineering and say sales or engineering and support are the biggest parts of the organization. And so they're the ones that need the most focused recruiting effort. Generally speaking, there's a global sourcing challenge with good engineers too. It just takes a lot of work to find good engineers. So I would lean towards a technical recruiter to start out as your first recruiter hire. Ideally someone that has the ability to source well and to do screening really well, because everybody gets pulled into the interview process when you're growing an organization and you want people to spend their time really wisely. Like the candidates that they see, you want them to have high probability of getting through the system, the interview process that you have set up, because they're really good candidates. And a good technical recruiter will handle a lot of that screening for you so that you're only talking to the candidates you really want to talk to.
And when we talk about sourcing, we're talking about outbound sourcing. So like sending LinkedIn messages and that sort of thing. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So inbound is you post a job and somebody applies and you do the culling of information with all your applicants. Outbound is we describe a particular position and the technical recruiter will look through networks and use LinkedIn tools and stuff like that to find candidates that they think would be a good fit and then try to entice them to come and interview with the company. They're technically two different roles, but recruiters typically have to do a mixture of both of them.
Right. And when we're hiring that first technical recruiter, What's your advice on how to make sure that there's someone that can source effectively and can do that technical screening, that first round of screening effectively?
Yeah, that's a great question. When I've interviewed recruiters in the past, I talk to them about how they assess technical fit and cultural fit in the company. So we go through like if I'm using a particular technical stack in that particular engineering organization, I'll talk to the recruiter about what they know about that technical stack and how they've sourced for that technical stack in the past, and what kind of companies they look at when they're trying to find engineers for that particular stack. And I don't expect recruiters to be engineers, but I do expect them to be able to differentiate between, say, a .NET stack and a PHP stack and a Go stack. Like they're just different. And I want recruiters to understand the difference and why you would kind of want to avoid companies that were really stuck in one particular stack. On the cultural side, that's just making sure cultural fit is, you know, is one third of the challenge of hiring, right? So you want to make sure that they know how to screen for cultural fit and that they both understand what the culture of the organization is that you're hiring them into, and they understand then how to screen for that initial fit.
So they need to have a good answer to the question, how do you screen for culture fit? Because that's a third. I'm curious, what are the other two thirds? If culture is a third.
So EQ, IQ, and CQ are the three vectors, right? EQ is emotional quotient, IQ is intelligent quotient, and CQ is cultural quotient. So
okay.
EQ, you want self-aware, humble, you know, thoughtful engineers like I do. Like those are the kinds of engineers I like to hire. Those are the kinds of engineers Zapier likes to hire. And you want to screen for that because, you know, the whole brilliant jerk persona, while they may accomplish a lot in the company, they're typically disruptive and they don't play as a team. So you want to screen for that. IQ is just raw skills. So the ability to do the mechanics of the job and to have some background in the stack, et cetera, of the stacks that you're using. And then cultural is what we're just talking about. CQ is the things that make your organization unique and the types of people that will fit well in that organization.
So I've been thinking a lot about you're hiring these folks for those three abilities, those three levels of fit. You're at 100 engineers roughly right now. I'd love to hear kind of the story as you've been hiring and growing the organization. How has the shape of the engineering org changed as you've grown?
Sure. So this year, 2019, we changed from a functionally organized engineering organization, so we have multiple front-end teams, multiple back-end teams, et cetera, to a product-focused organization, so engineering product design or EPD. So we structure ourselves around teams and zones. Zones are collections of teams. Teams have cross-functional capability, engineering capabilities, and they own a vertical slice of the product. So from top to bottom, the ability to make changes in the product and control the user experience, control the release cycle, the whole deal. And then we organize those similar teams into zones that are focused in particular parts of our user journey so that they can have shared sort of cross-team goals and stuff like that. So that's been the biggest change in 2019. The other thing has been a deliberate investment, although frankly, we're a little behind on the hiring for this part, but a deliberate investment in our infrastructure, the infrastructure part of engineering, which doesn't really fit into a product thing because it's more about
right.
the horizontal.
It's kind of horizontal, layer. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And then the other thing is our data engineering organization. That's they actually service the entire company, not just engineering. And we've been really thoughtful about designing the org structure for data engineering so that they sort of treat the company as their customer and that they have dedicated capacity for different aspects of the company. So those are kind of the three areas we've been investing in as we scale.
I want to dig into all three of those. We'll start with that. Those are great. I think I've seen more and more roles open for data engineering and people trying to figure out what that even means. Let's go back to that slice between a functional horizontal focus and that vertical product focus. If I'm currently at an organization where we're sliced on a front end team, back end team, what are some of the pains I might be encountering that might be evidence that I should consider switching to a product focused teams?
Yeah, the biggest thing is that your organization starts to feel like a matrixed organization. So if you've ever worked for a consulting firm or something like that, where you're billing people's hours against projects, that's typically a matrix style organization where you say, okay, we've got these clients and we need this amount of billable hours for a particular project. And then you have a pool of people and you kind of matrix them across these products, right? These clients. That's what matrix management looks like. And when you're on a functional team and the organization gets to a certain size, you'll find that your engineers just feel like they're stretched across a bunch of different parts of the product and they don't focus as much on one particular area. And the real challenge with that is that when you're trying to create the right customer experience in a particular part of the product, you want like focus on that. You want a clear product direction, you want a clear design direction, user experience direction, you want a clear engineering direction. And creating product focused teams helps create that alignment around the customer experience. So if you're feeling stretched too thin, if your managers are managing a whole bunch of people and really aren't being able to plug into one or two specific areas of the product, then that's probably a sign that you need to restructure.
That's a great summary. I've felt that before. So let's talk about infrastructure engineer. Actually, when you're building a product team, an EPM team, what's the right size for y'all? How many people?
Yeah, so it's trickier when you're remote because it's harder to have a lot of direct reports when you're remote. I think the ideal size is between 6 to 8 engineers on a team. That's kind of the typical Scrum team size, like, you know, stereotypical size. My personal experience is when you're in an office together, you can push the limits of that. So you can have a 10-person team and have a single manager managing all those folks. And that manager is still able to maintain connectivity with the team and camaraderie with the individuals and have time for one-on-ones and serendipitous conversations. When you're remote, all those interactions are scheduled, right? They're either in Slack, you know, as our sort of water cooler tool, or they're scheduled interactions. And it's just harder. I think all of us who have done both a mixture of remote and co-located work would say that a higher number of direct reports and co-located is just harder because it's harder to maintain those connections with folks. And your responsibility as a leader, one of your many responsibilities, but one of them is to maintain strong connectivity with your people so that you're helping them grow, you're giving them feedback, you're seeing where they're struggling and trying to solve those problems, you're making sure the team's working well together, all the sort of people management stuff. And that takes a certain amount of time.
6 to 8 for remote. And if you were co-located, you might be able to stretch it 8 to 10.
That's right. That's right. So that's my advice on that.
And how does product and design fit in there? Is that an addition to those 6 to 8? So it's really like 9, 10?
Yeah. So the way we do it here is engineering management, product management, and design are like a trio of leaders for the team. So while the engineers report to the engineering manager, the ideal incarnation of an EPD trio is that the three members of that trio are collectively deciding the direction of the product. So it's not, there are obviously unique responsibilities for each particular person in that trio, but collectively they're able to represent each other as kind of a first team. They're able to talk about the direction. They're able to debate specific areas. They're able to figure out the right investments that they need to make, like how much is just enough to build an experience, how much experimentation should we do before we invest a ton of effort, et cetera. So in that particular case, the design and product management, they're sort of leaders. They're not necessarily individual contributors in that case. They're kind of leaders on the team. That's the ideal. In practice, you know, people have specialties and a designer might want to be more in the weeds and building more of the deep design and maybe less interested in the implementation mechanics or something like that. But ideally you want this trio of three to kind of run the team.
Gotcha. So we got three leaders, EPM, and then we've got 6 to 8 engineers, and that's kind of like our classical team.
Scaling Software Teams is brought to you by my startup, Woven. At Woven, we help high-growth teams hire better developers faster and with less engineering effort. We do that by finding hidden gems in your candidate pool. 1/3 of our customers' hires are folks that would have been rejected with a standard resume screen. And we do all that while delivering a great candidate experience, complete with detailed feedback. Instead of taking it from me, I think you should hear from our customers' candidates. Here is a real quote from a real software engineer about our work simulations and feedback.
I enjoyed doing this assessment as it was an actual representation of my coding abilities as opposed to solving a bizarre sorting algorithm or data structure.
If you want to judge for yourself, we'd be happy to build you a tailored demo so you can play with it on your own time. Go to woventeams.com/demo to get started. That's woventeams.com/demo.
So Stripe's infrastructure engineering, their take is you need at least 8 engineers to have an on-call rotation that doesn't make people crazy. And then I've talked to like Drift, their take is they have pods of 2 to 3 engineers, and they'll have 2 pods of 2 to 3 in one, I think it's squad, maybe is their name. And then that squad has design, product, and then an engineering leader. So there's lots of different ways to slice this
Yeah, that's really interesting. The pod one is new to me. I don't think I've heard of that small of a structure. I'm guessing there are like pair programming type efforts or something like that that would a small pod would be useful to have. But yeah, that's it's an interesting model.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think they do a decent amount of that kind of work. And the stated goal, a stated benefit is you can think of that pod of engineers as like one unit of work rather than having two. It like creates an abstraction for an engineering unit of work, which is interesting. So let's talk a little bit. I'd love to hear more about how you're organizing that data engineering team to see the internal users as customers. Are we talking like marketing, sales? Like how does that work in practice?
So we have product zones, which are collections of teams, and then we have other zones in the company like finance and support and marketing and the executive team that are other zones of that deliver things right for the company, right? All of the zones, all of these company level zones have data analytics requirements. So sometimes it's just analyzing how things are going and so that we can make decisions. Sometimes it's doing experimentation to see what's working and not working, but it requires a certain amount of data smarts. Our data organization for the company is a mixture of decision science and data operations. Those are our two sort of, they're two sort of separate parts of the organization that work together for the success of data. So each particular zone, our ideal staffing model, we're building this out right now, but our ideal staffing model is each company level zone has a decision scientist. Some people call this a data analyst, right? It depends on the exact skill sets of the person. But a decision scientist / data analyst is one role and a data engineer is the second role. So that team of two is the service part of the a part of data for each of the company zones. And then inside of data operations or data engineering, if you want to call it that, there's other stuff. So there's a data product group, which builds products that are usable across the organization, internal and then bought products that are usable across the organization. There's data governance, which is relatively new for us, but trying to keep data consistent so that the things we have in Looker and our data pipeline and stuff like that and our eventing system is consistent across the products so that you can do good at analytics. And then there's just the general management of data engineering, which we have to do because those are spread out across the zones.
Let me see if I can repeat that back. So we've got kind of a central data operations that does governance and builds products that are across the org. And then each zone has a team of two that is kind of customers to that central data, products. And they are, I guess they're getting really close to that zone, that functional area to really understand their problems. Is that kind of the idea of the embedding?
That's correct. That's correct.
Interesting. So you don't have one data person that's getting drug around to all different, okay, you have to understand support, you have to understand sales, you understand marketing, you can kind of embed them a little closer.
I mean, yeah, we're trying to move from that ladder model where there's just a couple of data people, but especially in decision sciences that just have to service everybody to much more focused investment. Zapier, like most modern companies now, is very data centric. Like we measure everything, we analyze everything. We just want to understand. We want to have a clear, objective understanding of how things are working, and that requires a significant investment in data. So we're sort of trying to scale decision science and data operations with the rest of the company in a thoughtful way.
So let's move to your infrastructure kind of side of things. So you've got 100 engineers. How big should that infrastructure group B, or what's your target?
Yeah, that's a good question. Let's say 20%, I'd say.
Okay.
What we're looking at, it's actually probably will go higher because we're next year because we're making a bunch of big architectural investments. But you're right to note that we're trying to achieve a percentage that so that the infrastructure organization scales with the company. Is what happens is it's more step function. Like you have a one size infrastructure organization and the rest of the company expands really quickly. And then suddenly infrastructure can't keep up. That's kind of where we're at right now. Like the infrastructure team is really inundated with stuff they have to work on. And so we're trying to establish more of a percentage. I think we're going to end the year at 20 to 25% for Zapier today. So that's roughly what I would say for right now. I should probably talk about what infrastructure actually means here, because that's important. So people describe it differently. So for us, it's SRE and DevOps style work, which we're calling release engineering right now, but I think that's going to evolve as we build out what we want systems to look like over the next couple of years. But we want a mixture of co-owned collectively owned stuff inside of infrastructure, and then we want SRE level capabilities across the rest of the product organization, so that there's some self-service that the product teams can do without requiring infrastructure team. It's kind of a hybrid SRE model. We also have a horizontal services team. We haven't properly named this yet, but for services that all of the teams need, whether it's user identity management or events, the event streaming system or API gateways, stuff like that. We want to make sure that we've got a team that's supporting all of that stuff, so that we're so that not one particular product team necessarily has to maintain something that everybody else uses. We also have security in this infrastructure zone right now. For our size of company, that's normal to have security as part of infrastructure. As you grow to a bigger company, security usually becomes its own function. But right now, the vast majority of our investment in security is focused on engineering related work. And then there's a developer effectiveness team as well inside of infrastructure, which is really about our, it's a bit of a hybrid right now. So it's got a little bit of the CI/CD pipeline. It's got the development tooling associated with it. And right now we're trying to just improve the developer experience, because we use Docker for, on laptop development of the infrastructure, and it's a pretty beefy payload and it drags the system down. So we want to speed that process up so it's easier to develop code and push code. Our deployment pipeline is pretty solid, but the actual development environment is, it works, but it's a lot of resources to get it running.
And we're right now on kind of like, fully microservices, everything can be deployed independently to a kind of monolith. Everything goes at once. Where are you on that continuum right now?
We're mostly a monolith right now. So we're in the process of designing the architecture to break that up into more service-oriented, server/serverless architecture. It's going to be a mixture of both. So we're kind of at the beginning of stages of that. We've got a lot of great ideas, a lot of sort of stuff on paper, but getting it into an implementation plan is kind of our Q4 exercise today at Zapier, to just so that we can have a multi-year investment in this architectural evolution.
So I sometimes see on Twitter people that have strong opinions that if you don't go microservices by X number of engineers, that you're hosed. I think y'all are an example that that's probably not the case. If you're at your scale, 100 engineers, and you said your deployment pipeline's working well, it seems like.
It's working well, but it's a monolithic. I mean, it's a staged deployment pipeline, of course, but the mono repo gets deployed all at once, right? So that's not efficient, and it's the problem that we're having is that engineers can accidentally step on each other when we're doing development. You can accidentally, that's more of an issue of tendrils of code and less of an issue of the deployment pipeline, but
gotcha.
It's easy to accidentally break things. So what we really have to do architecturally is create some loose coupling between teams technically, so that we can then do fancier things with the deployment pipeline. But it's really that technical loose coupling. I generally agree with this philosophy that at some point you have to get out of the monolithic world. And at what point you do this, I think depends on the type of SaaS product you have. If you have a SaaS product that's where there's a lot of users inside the user experience of the product at any given time, that tends to break down faster. A product like Zapier, where the core engine that runs the Zaps is kind of a separate thing, and the editor is something you use whenever you just need to adjust that, buys us some runway to do this, because not all of our customers are in the product at the same time, right? You don't have to be.
Like I've used thousands and thousands of Zaps, but I think I've used the editor, small dozens of times.
Right. So that helps us a lot. And our Zap engine is already serverless. So that part is in great shape. And it's why we have really good reliability on, even if the editor's behaving strangely, your Zaps are still running. Like that's the part of what makes the platform resilient right now. But we have more to do. And certainly separating the monolith is a necessary component to us continuing to scale the engineering organization efficiently.
Thanks again to Doug for sharing his experience with us. Here are a few takeaways I had from our chat. Number one, a product-focused org structure allows our team to focus more deeply on user needs. That creates innovation. A product-focused organization means engineering, product, and design work closely together. It's not engineering-focused, it's not design-focused, it's product-focused. And that's that three legs of the stool, engineering, product, and design. Zapier splits between teams and zones. A zone is kind of what you might traditionally think of as a department. And a team has a cross-functional view to own a vertical slice of the product. So what's a vertical slice? Let's think of a parfait where we have multiple layers and we have, you know, we've got some yogurt, we've got some nuts, we've got some fruits. A horizontal slice would be just the fruit. So that might be front-end engineering or back-end engineering. A vertical slice has a whole nice mix of ingredients. A vertical slice in a product standpoint might be a particular flow in our product that's kind of standalone. So think of, in Zapier's case, a vertical slice might be the tool that builds workflows and helps you configure a particular Zap. Another vertical slice might be the tool that helps you discover other workflows. So we can divide that vertical slice so a given team with engineering, product, and design can ship on their own, can run experiments on their own. It allows them to innovate. The alternative might be a matrixed organization, which creates some problems. Doug has worked in an organization like that in the past, and you start to feel like, as an engineer, you're billing hours to a client. You're kind of splitting your time between lots of different projects. You don't get to put your whole brain in it. So it really does harm innovation and also causes some switching costs, and maybe you just feel stretched thin. When you're building a product team focused on that vertical slice of a product, the size is really important. Zapier is remote, and they believe that if you're remote, you can't have as many direct reports. Co-located does make things a little bit easier when it comes to management. So ideally, on a remote team, they look for 6 to 8 on a product team. If you're co-located, Doug thinks you can maybe stretch that to 8 to 10. Remote is harder, because everything really needs to be scheduled. You're not going to run into someone in the kitchen and notice their demeanor and then have a conversation. You're going to have to schedule that interaction and also team bonding. Number two, a zone-based embedded team structure can really help with the effectiveness of the data team. It allows them to serve the whole org more effectively. Data science and data engineering are an unmistakable trend. More and more organizations are hiring these folks and doing it earlier and earlier. A common struggle I hear is how to get the most value out of those really expensive, really smart people. How can we actually make an impact through the org as a whole? One model is the kind of unembedded model, the internal agency model, where you have a data science team and parts of the org will go and talk to the data science team and bring in projects. Zapier has moved away from that model. They've moved towards a model where every zone or department, so let's think marketing, finance, they have, each of those zones have some sort of data organization, data needs. What Zapier does is they embed data operations and or decision science into that specific org. That way, that data scientist are just really engrossed in the domain. They understand the problems, allows them to see innovation. And then across the org, there's also a data product group who is building things for those embedded data operations, decision scientists who might be in marketing, finance. So data product group builds things that are used by the embedded data scientists. And then that there's also a data governance group that ensures analytics are consistent across the org. And there's also some general management of data engineering org-wide to create a great pipeline. The result is those data scientists being embedded deeply into the part of the organization where they could really understand the problem and really make a difference for those teams. Number three, it is very possible to manage a monolith past 100 developers. Zapier defines infrastructure as their SRE and DevOps work. They have about 100 engineers total. They scale their infrastructure unit, this is SRE and DevOps, to 20 to 25% of their engineering group. And Doug uses that heuristic of you want about 20% of your engineers to be infrastructure as a model to keep in mind as he scales. Sometimes that flex is a little larger. So if you are converting from a monolith to a microservice, making some big architectural change, maybe you want to be on the high end. 25, 30% of your group might be infrastructure. If things are more steady state, maybe you want to be towards the low end, that 20%. They also have a horizontal services team for services that all of the teams need that might be taking a vertical product slice, which a vertical product slice might be, you know, workflow builder. Workflow builder needs, the Zap Builder needs user ID management, API gateways, all that stuff. So that's horizontal services. The security group is also part of their infrastructure zone at Zapier. That seems to be normal for their size of org. He anticipates having a separate security group once they reach a certain level of scale. They also have a developer effectiveness team. So this is the hybrid, you know, CI, CD pipeline, dev tooling, everything that's about improving developer experience and productivity. Zapier is mostly a monolith right now, and they're working effectively with 100 engineers. Doug does see a time when they need to move away from that, and I think they're actively working in that direction. Some of the problems you might experience that would signal that you might need to look at microservices is if you're investing in tooling, you've got 20% of your engineering is infrastructure, and you're still running into situations where engineers can step on each other, accidentally break things. Their goal is to create more loose coupling between teams, and the microservices architecture is one tool to achieve that looser coupling. Thanks again to Doug for coming on the show. Next week, we'll release part two of our conversation where we talked about Doug's leadership and management style, managing remote. And in the meantime, I want to hear from you. Please leave us a review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcast. This will help others find our community. Until next week, keep on scaling.